they began to talk. In a while, they were chatting, carefully, guardedly, and she, at least, was looking forward to his being there. By the time she knew that his name was Henry Porter and that he had occasional yard work in that part of town, she was glad she had never shown or mentioned either the card or the man to anyone. Pleasant as their conversations were, they were also curious. Each took care not to ask the other certain questions, for fear he or she would have to volunteer the same information. What part of town do you live in? Do you know Mr. So-and-so? Eventually, Mr. Porter offered to pick Corinthians up after work. He didn't own the car, he said, but borrowed a friend sometimes. Corinthians agreed, and the result was a pair of middle-aged lovers who behaved like teenagers, afraid to be caught by their parents in a love relationship they were too young for. He took her for rides in an old gray Oldsmobile, to the country, to drive-in movies, and they sat over bad coffee in certain dime stores where they were not likely to be recognized. Corinthians knew she was ashamed of him, that she would have to add him to the other secret, the nature of her work, that he could never set foot in her house. And she hated him a lot for the shame she felt. Hated him sometimes right in the middle of his obvious adoration of her, his frequent compliments about her looks, her manners, her voice. But those swift feelings of contempt never lasted long enough for her to refuse those drive-in movie sessions where she was the sole object of someone's hunger and satisfaction. At some point, Corinthians began to suspect that Porter's discretion was not only in deference to who she was, her position and all, but also because he too didn't want to be discovered. Her first thought was that he was married. His denials, accompanied by a wistful smile, which she interpreted as a sly one, only aggravated her suspicions. Finally, to prove his bachelorhood as well as to indulge himself in a real bed, he invited her to his room. She declined immediately and repeatedly for several days until he accused her of the very thing that was absolutely true, that she was ashamed of him. Ashamed of you? Her eyes and mouth went wide with surprise, genuine surprise, because she never thought he would guess it. If I were ashamed, I wouldn't see you at all, let alone this way. Her hand pointed toward the world outside the car they sat in, the row upon row of automobiles in the hot drive-in movie lot. Porter traced her cheek line with his knuckle. Well, then, the things you tell me can't be true and not true at the same time. I've never told you anything except what was true. I thought we both knew, understood the problem. Maybe, he said. Let's hear it, Corey. His knuckles stroked her jawline. Let's hear the problem. My father. It's only my father, the way he is. How is he? Corinthians shrugged. You know as well as I do. He never wanted us to mix with people. He's very strict. And that's the reason you won't come home with me. I'm sorry, I have to live there. I can't let him know about us. Not yet. But when, she thought. If not at 44, then when? If not now, when even my pubic hair is turning gray, and when my breasts have dropped of their own accord, then when? Porter spoke her own question aloud. When then? And she could not answer him right away. She put her fingers to her forehead and said, I don't know. I honestly don't know. It was such a fake gesture to go along with her fake feelings of moral and filial commitment that she knew right away how foolish she seemed. The things they did in that old car, the things she'd let her tongue say as recently as 5 minutes ago, and now to caress her temples and say in Michael Mary's reading voice, I don't know, embarrassed her and must have disgusted Porter, for he took his hand away from her face and put it on the steering wheel. Right at the beginning of the second feature, he started the car and moved it slowly down the gravel aisle. Neither spoke until the car entered downtown traffic. It was 10:30. She told her mother she would be typing manuscript for Miss Graham until very late. In this heat, was all her mother said. Corinthian sat quietly, feeling shame, but not thinking the word, until she realized that he was driving her to the bus stop, where he always let her out to walk home the way she normally would. In a sudden flash, she knew he was never going to see her again, and the days rolled out before her like a dingy gray carpet in an unfurnished, unpeopled hall for rent. Are you taking me home? She succeeded in keeping anxiety out of her voice. Succeeded too well, for her words sounded arrogant and careless. He nodded and said, I don't want a doll baby. I want a woman, a grown-up woman that's not scared of her daddy. I guess you don't want to be a grown-up woman, Corey. She stared through the windshield. A grown-up woman? She tried to think of some. Her mother, Lena, the dean of women at Bryn Mawr, Michael Mary, the ladies who visited her mother and ate cake. Somehow none of them fit. She didn't know any grown-up women. Every woman she knew was a doll baby. Did he mean like the women who rode on the bus? The other maids who were not hiding what they were? Or the black women who walked the streets at night? You mean like those women on the bus? You could have one of them, you know. Why don't you drop a greeting card in one of their laps? His words had hit home. She had been compared unfavorably, she believed, with the only people she knew for certain she was superior to. They'd love to have a greeting card dropped in their lap, just love it. But, oh, I forgot. You couldn't do that, could you? Because they wouldn't be able to read it. They'd have to take it home and wait till Sunday and give it to the preacher to read to them. Of course, when they heard it, they might not know what it meant, but it wouldn't matter. They'd see the flowers and the curlicues all over the words, and they'd be happy. It wouldn't matter a bit that it was the most ridiculous, most cliched, most commercial piece of tripe the drugstore world has to offer. They wouldn't know mediocrity if it punched them right in their fat faces. They'd laugh and slap their fat thighs and take you right on into their kitchens, right up on the breakfast table. But you wouldn't give them a 15-cent greeting card, would you? No matter how silly and stupid it was, because they're grown-up women, and you don't have to court them. You can just come right out and say, hello there. Come on to my room tonight, right? Isn't that so? Isn't that so? She was close to screaming. But no, you wanted a lady, somebody who knows how to sit down, how to dress, how to eat the food on her plate. Well, there is a difference between a woman and a lady, and I know you know which one I am. Porter pulled the car over to the curb, and without shutting off the motor, leaned across her and opened the door. Corinthians got out and did her best to slam it, but the rusty hinges of the borrowed Oldsmobile did not accommodate her. She had to settle for the gesture. By the time she reached number 12, not Doctor Street, her trembling had become uncontrollable. Suddenly the shaking stopped, and she froze at the steps. 2 seconds later, she turned on her heel and ran back down the street to where Porter had stopped the car. The moment she had put her foot on the step leading up to the porch, she saw her ripeness mellowing and rotting before a heap of red velvet scraps on a round oak table. The car was still there, its motor purring. Corinthians ran toward it faster than she had ever run in her life, faster than she'd cut across the grass on Honoré Island when she was 5 and the whole family went there for a holiday, faster even than the time she flew down the stairs, having seen for the first time what the disease had done to her grandfather. She put her hand on the door handle and found it locked. Porter was sitting pretty much the way he was when she tried to slam the door. Bending down, she rapped on the window. Porter's profile did not move. She rapped again, louder, mindless of who might see her under the gray beech tree just around the corner from home. So close, and yet so far, she felt as though she were in a dream, there but not there, within a hair's breadth but not reaching it. She was First Corinthians dead, daughter of a wealthy property owner, and the elegant Ruth Foster, granddaughter of the magnificent and worshipped Dr. Foster, who had been the second man in the city to have a 2-horse carriage, and a woman who had turned heads on every deck of the Queen Mary and had Frenchmen salivating all over Paris. Corinthians dead, who had held herself pure all these years, well, almost all, and almost pure, was now banging on the car door window of a yard man. But she would bang forever to escape the velvet, the red velvet that had flown all over the snow that day when she and Lena and her mother had walked past the hospital on their way to the department store. Her mother was pregnant, a fact that had embarrassed Corinthians when she first learned of it. All she could think of was how her friends would laugh when they found out she had a pregnant mother. Her relief was sweet when she discovered that it was too soon to show. But by February, her mother was heavy and needed to get out of the house to exercise a little. They walked slowly through the snow, watching carefully for icy places. Then, as they passed Mercy, there was a crowd watching a man on the roof. Corinthians had seen him before her mother did, but when Ruth looked up, she was so startled she dropped the basket, scattering the roses everywhere. Corinthians and Lena busied themselves picking them up, wiping the snow from the cloth on their coats, all the while peeping at the man in blue wings on the hospital roof. They were laughing, Lena and she, collecting the roses, looking up at the man, and laughing from fear, embarrassment, and giddiness. It was all mixed together, the red velvet, the screams, and the man crashing down on the pavement. She had seen his body quite clearly, and to her astonishment, there was no blood. The only red in view was in their own hands and in the basket. Her mother's groans were getting louder, and she seemed to be sinking into the ground. A stretcher came at last for the doll broken body, all the more doll-like because there was no blood, and finally a wheelchair for her mother, who was moving straight into labor. Corinthians continued to make roses, but she hated that stupid hobby and gave Lena any excuse to avoid it. They spoke to her of death. First, the death of the man in the blue wings, now her own. For if Porter did not turn his head, and leaned toward the door to open it for her, Corinthians believed she would surely die. She banged her knuckles until they ached to get the attention of the living flesh behind the glass, and would have smashed her fist through the window just to touch him, feel his heat, the only thing that could protect her from a smothering death of dry roses. He did not move. In a panic lest he shift gears and drive away, leaving her alone in the street, Corinthians climbed up on the fender and lay full out across the hood of the car. She didn't look through the windshield at him. She just lay there, stretched across the car, her fingers struggling for a grip on steel. She thought of nothing, nothing except what her body needed to do to hang on, to never let go. Even if he drove off at 100 miles an hour, she would hang on. Her eyes were shut tight with the effort of clinging to the hood, and she didn't hear the door open and shut, nor Porter's footsteps as he moved around to the front of the car. She screamed at first when he put his hand on her shoulders and began pulling her gently into his arms. He carried her to the passenger side of the car, stood her on her feet while he opened the door and helped her ease into the seat. In the car, he pressed her head onto his shoulder and waited for her soft crying to wane before he left the driver's seat to pick up the purse she had let fall on the sidewalk. He drove away then to number 3, 15th Street, a house owned by Macon Dead, where 16 tenants lived, and where there was an attic window from which this same Henry Porter had screamed, wept, waved a shotgun, and urinated over the heads of the women in the yard. It was not yet midnight, and hot, hot enough to make people angry, had it not been for a pleasant smell in the air, like sweet ginger. Corinthians and Porter entered the hall that opened off the front door. Except for a hem of light under the kitchen door where a card game was in progress, there was no sign of any other tenant. Corinthians saw only the bed, an iron bed painted hospital white. She sank down on it as soon as she got into the room and stretched out, feeling bathed, scoured, vacuumed, and for the first time, simple. Porter undressed after she did and lay down beside her. They were quiet for a minute. Then he turned over and parted her legs with his. Corinthians looked down at him. "Is this for me?" she asked. "Yes," he said. "Yes, this is for you. Porter, this is for you. Instead of roses and silk underwear and bottles of perfume, Porter, instead of chocolate creams and a heart-shaped box, instead of a big house and a great big car, instead of long trips, Porter in a clean white boat, no. Instead of picnics, no. And fishing, no. And being old together on a porch, no. This is for you, girl. Oh, yes. This is for you." They woke at 4 o'clock in the morning, or rather she did, when she opened her eyes and saw him staring at her, and those were either tears in his eyes or sweat. It was very hot in that room, in spite of the open window. "The bathroom," she murmured. "Where is the bathroom?" "Down the hall," he said. Then, apologetically, "Can I get you something?" "Oh," she pushed a few strands of matted damp hair from her forehead. "Something to drink, please. Something cold." He dressed quickly, leaving off his shirt and his socks, and left the room. Corinthians got up too, and began to put her clothes on, since there seemed to be no mirror in the room She stood in front of the open window and used the upper part of the pane, dark enough to show her reflection, to smooth her hair. Then she noticed the walls. What she had assumed to be wallpaper as she entered and fell on the bed was in fact calendars. Row after row of calendars. S&J Automobile Parts, featuring a 1939 Hudson, the Cuyahoga River Construction Company, We Build to Please, We're Pleased to Build, Lucky Heart Beauty Products, a wavy-haired lady smiling out of a heavily powdered face, the Call and Post newspaper. But most of them were from the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company. They literally covered the walls. Each one turned to December. It was as though he'd kept every calendar since 1939. Some of them were large cards displaying all 12 months, and on those she noticed circles drawn around dates. Porter came in while she was gazing at them. He held a glass of iced water, the cubes jammed to the rim. "Why do you keep calendars?" she asked. He smiled. "Passes the time. Here, drink your drink. It'll cool you." She took the glass and sipped a little from it, trying to keep the ice from touching her teeth as she looked at him over the rim. Standing there barefoot, her hair damp with sweat and sticking to her cheeks like paint, she felt easy. In place of vanity, she now felt a self-esteem that was quite new. She was grateful to him, this man who rented a tiny room from her father, who ate with a knife and did not even own a pair of dress shoes. A perfect example of the men her parents had kept her from, and whom she had also kept herself from all her life, because such a man was known to beat his woman, betray her, shame her, and leave her. Corinthians moved close to him, tilted his chin up with her fingers, and planted a feathery kiss on his throat. He held her head in his hands until she closed her eyes and tried to set the glass down on a tiny table. It'll be light soon. Gotta get you home. She obeyed and finished dressing herself. They walked as softly as possible down the stairs and past the wide triangle of light that lay on the floor in front of the kitchen door. The men were still at their card game, but the door was partially open now. Porter and Corinthians moved quickly past, just out of the light. Still, a voice called, "Who that, Mary?" "No, just me, Porter." "Porter?" The voice was incredulous. "What shift you on?" "Catch you later," said Porter, and opened the front door before the speaker's curiosity could propel him into the hall. Corinthians slid as close to Porter as the floor gear of the car allowed, her head resting on the seat back. She closed her eyes once more and took deep breaths of the sweet air her brother had been inhaling 3 hours ago. "Hadn't you better fix your hair?" Porter asked. He thought she was beautiful like that, girlish, but he didn't want her excuse to her parents, if they were still awake, to sound ridiculous. She shook her head. She wouldn't have collected her hair into a ball at her nape now for anything in the world. Porter parked under the same tree where Corinthians had thrown herself across the hood of the car. Now, after a whispered confession, she walked the 4 blocks, no longer afraid to mount the porch steps. As soon as she closed the door, she heard voices and instinctively touched her loose hair. The voices came from beyond the dining room, from behind the closed kitchen door, men's voices. Corinthians blinked. She had just come from a house in which men sat in a lit kitchen talking in loud, excited voices, only to meet an identical scene at home. She wondered if this part of the night, a part she was unfamiliar with, belonged, had always belonged, to men. If perhaps it was a secret hour in which men rose like giants from dragons' teeth, and while the women slept, clustered in their kitchens. On tiptoe, she approached the door. Her father was speaking. "You still haven't explained to me why you brought him along. What difference does it make now?" That was her brother's voice. "He knows about it," said her father. "That's what difference." "About what? There's nothing to know. It was a bust." Milkman's voice swelled like a blister. "It was a mistake, not a bust. It just means it's somewhere else. That's all." "Yeah, the mint. You want me to go to the mint?" "No," Macon struck the table. "It's got to be there. It's got to." Corinthians couldn't make sense out of what they were talking about with so much passion, and she didn't want to stay there and learn, lest it distract her from the contentment she was feeling. She left them and climbed the stairs to her own bed. Downstairs in the kitchen, Milkman folded his arms on the table and put his head down. "I don't care. I don't care where it is." "It was just a mistake," said his father. "One little mess up. That don't mean we have to pull out. You call being thrown in jail a little mess up? You out, ain't you? You was only there 20 minutes. 2 hours. Wouldn't have been 2 minutes if you had called me soon as you got there. Sooner. Should have called me soon as they picked you up. Police cars don't have telephones in them." Milkman was weary. He lifted his head and let it rest in his hand, directing his words into his shirt sleeve. "They would have let you if it just been you. Soon as you told them your name, they would have let you go. But you was with that Southside nigger, that's what did it." "That is not what did it. It was riding around with a sack of rocks and human bones that did it. Human bones, which is, if you're a halfway intelligent cop, a hint that there must have been a human being connected to them bones at one time." "Of course at one time, but not tonight. There couldn't have been a human attached to the bones yesterday. It takes time for a body to be a skeleton. They know that. And don't tell me it wasn't guitar they were suspicious of. That yellow-eyed nigger looks like he might do anything." "They didn't see his eyes when they told us to pull over. They didn't see nothing. They just sideswiped us and told us to get out." "Now what was that for? What'd they stop us for? We wasn't speeding, just driving along." Milkman searched for cigarettes. He got angry again when he thought about bending over the car, his legs spread, his hands on the hood, while the policeman fingered his legs, his back, his ass, his arms. What business they got stopping cars that ain't speeding? "They stop anybody they want to. They saw you was colored, that's all, and they're looking for the Negro that killed that boy." "Who said it was a Negro?" "Paper said it. They always say that. Every time. What difference does it make? If you'd been alone and told them your name, they never would have hauled you in, never would have searched the car, and never would have opened that sack. They know me. You saw how they acted when I got there. They didn't act any different when you got there." "What? They acted different when you took that sucker off in the corner and opened your wallet." "You better be thankful I got a wallet." "I am. God knows I am. And that would have been the end of it, except for that Southside nigger. Hadn't been for him, they wouldn't have had to get Pilot down there." Macon rubbed his knees. The idea of having to depend on Pilot to get his son out of jail humiliated him. "Raggedy bootlegging bitch." "She's still a bitch." Milkman began to chuckle. Exhaustion and the slow release of tension made him giddy. "You thought she stole it. All these years, you've been holding that against her." He was laughing outright now. How she sneaked out of some cave with a big bag of gold that must have weighed 100 pounds over her shoulder, all over the country for 50 years, and didn't spend none of it, just hung it from a ceiling like a fucking sack of onions? Milkman put his head back and let the laughter fill the kitchen. Macon was silent. 50 years. You've been thinking about that goal for 50 years. Oh, shit. This is some crazy shit. Tears of laughter were running from his eyes. Crazy, all of you. Just straight out, laid back crazy. I should have known. The whole thing was crazy. Everything about it was crazy. The whole idea. What's crazier? Her hauling a sack of gold around all this time, or hauling a dead man's bones around? Huh. Which one? Macon asked. I don't know. I really don't know. If she'd do one, she could do the other. She's the one they should have kept. When you all told them the bones belonged to her, they should have locked her up soon she walked in the door. Milkman wiped the tears on his sleeve. Lock her up for what? After that story she told? He started laughing again. She came in there like Louise Beaver and Butterfly McQueen, all rolled up in one. Yes, a boss. Yes, a boss. She didn't say that. Almost. She even changed her voice. I told you she was a snake. Drop her skin in a split second. She didn't even look the same. She looked short. Short and pitiful. That's 'cause she wanted it back. She wanted them to let her have the bones back. Her poor husband's bones that she didn't have no money to bury. Pilate got a husband somewhere? Does the Pope? Well, she got him back. They gave him to her. She knew what she was doing all right. Yeah, she knew. But how did she know so fast? I mean, she came in there, you know, prepared. She had it all together when she got there. Cop must have told her everything when he picked her up and brought her to the station. Uh-uh, they don't do that. Then how did she know? Who knows what Pilate knows? Milkman shook his head. Only the shadow knows. He was still amused, but earlier, when he and Guitar had sat handcuffed on a wooden bench, his neck skin had crawled with fear. White man's bones, Macon said. He stood up and yawned. The dark of the sky was softened now. Nigger bitch roaming around with white man's bones. He yawned again. I'll never understand that woman. I'm 72 years old, and I'm going to die not understanding one thing about her. Macon walked toward the kitchen door and opened it. Then he turned around and said to Milkman, "But you know what that means, don't you? If she took the white man's bones and left the gold, then the gold must still be there." He shut the door before his son could protest. Well, it would rot there, thought Milkman. If anybody even mentions the word gold, I'm going to have to take his teeth out. He sat on there in the kitchen, wishing for more coffee, but too tired to get up and fix it. In a minute, his mother would be downstairs. She had got up when he and Macon had come in, but Macon sent her back upstairs. Milkman fished for another cigarette and watched Dawn eclipse the electric light over the sink. It was a cheery sun, which suggested another hot day. But the stronger it got, the more desolate he became. Alone, without Macon, he let the events of the night come back to him. He remembered little things, details, and yet he wasn't sure these details had really happened. Perhaps he made them up. Pilate had been shorter. As she stood there in the receiving room of the jail, she didn't even come up to the sergeant's shoulder, and the sergeant's head barely reached Milkman's own chin. But Pilate was as tall as he was. When she whined to the policeman, verifying Milkman's and Guitar's lie that they had ripped off the sack as a joke on an old lady, she had to look up at him, and her hands were shaking as she described how she didn't know the sack was gone until the officer woke her up, that she couldn't imagine why anybody would want to run off with her husband's bones, that her husband had been lynched in Mississippi 15 years ago, and that they wouldn't let her cut him down, and that she left town then, and that when she went back, the body had dropped off the rope of its own accord, so she collected it and tried to bury it. But the funeral peoples wanted $50 for a coffin, and the carpenter wanted $12.50 for a pine box, and she just didn't have no $12.50. So she just carried what was left of Mr. Solomon. She always called him Mr. Solomon, 'cause he was such a dignified colored man, and put it in a sack and kept it with her. Bible say, whatsoever the Lord hath brought together, let no man put asunder. Matthew 21:2. We was bony fied and legal wed, sir, she pleaded. Even her eyes, those big, sleepy old eyes, were small as she went on. So I thought I'd just as well keep him near me, and when I die, they can put him in the same hold as me. We'll raise up to judgment day together, hand in hand. Milkman was astonished. He thought Pilate's only acquaintance with the Bible was the getting of names out of it. But she quoted it, apparently, verse and chapter. Furthermore, she had looked at Milkman and Guitar and Macon like she didn't know who exactly they were. In fact, when asked if she knew them, she pointedly said, "Not this man here," looking at her brother, "but I do believe I've noticed this fellow around the neighborhood." Here she motioned toward Guitar, who sat there like marble, with the eyes of a dead man. Later, as Macon drove them all home, Pilate sitting in front, Guitar and himself in the back, Guitar never said a word. His anger was like heat, shimmering out of his skin, making the hot air blowing in through the open window seem refreshing by comparison. And again there was a change. Pilate was tall again. The top of her head, wrapped in a silk rag, almost touched the roof of the car, as did theirs. And her own voice was back. She spoke, but to Macon only, and nobody else spoke at all. In a conversational tone, like somebody picking up a story that had been interrupted in the telling, she told her brother something quite different from what she told the policeman. "I spent that whole day and night in there, and when I looked out the next morning, you was gone. I was scared I would run into you, but I didn't see hide nor hair of you. It was 3 years or more before I went back. The winter it was. Snow was everywhere, and I couldn't hardly find my way. I looked up Circe first, then went looking for the cave. It was a hard trek, I can tell you, and I was in frail condition. Snow piled up every which way. But you should have known better than to think I'd go back there for them little old bags. I wasn't stunting them when I first laid eyes on them. I sure wasn't thinking about them 3 years later. I went 'cause Papa told me to. He kept coming to see me off and on, tell me things to do. First he just told me to sing, to keep on singing. Sing, he's whisper. Sing, sing. Then right after Reba was born, he came and told me outright, 'You just can't fly off and leave a body,' he told me. 'A human life is precious. You shouldn't fly off and leave it.' So I knew right away what he meant, 'cause he was right there when we did it. He meant that if you take a life, then you own it. You're responsible for it. You can't get rid of nobody by killing them. They're still there. They're yours now. So I had to go back for it. And I did find the cave, and there he was. Some wolves or something must have drug it, 'cause it was right in the mouth of the cave, laying up, sitting up, almost, on that very rock we slept on. I put him in my sack, piece by piece. Some cloth was still on him, but his bones was clean and dry. I've had it ever since. Papa told me to. And he was right, you know. You can't take a life and walk off and leave it. Life is life, precious, and the dead you kill is yours. They stay with you anyway, in your mind. So it's a better thing, a more better thing, to have the bones right there with you, wherever you go. That way, it frees up your mind. Fucks up your mind, thought Milkman. Fucks it up for good. He pulled himself up from the table. He had to get some sleep before he went looking for a guitar. Staggering up the stairs, he remembered Pilot's back as she got out of the Buick, not bent at all under the weight of the sack. And he remembered how Guitar glared at her as she walked away from the car. When Macon dropped him off, he neither answered nor turned his head at Milkman's "see you later." Milkman woke at noon. Somebody had come into his room and placed a small fan on the floor near the foot of his bed. He listened to the whirring for a long time before he got up and went into the bathroom to fill the tub. He lay there in lukewarm water, still sweating, too hot and tired to soap himself. Every now and then he flicked water on his face, letting it wet his two-day-old beard. He wondered if he could shave without slicing his chin open. The tub was uncomfortable, too short for him to stretch out, though he remembered when he could almost swim in it. Now he looked down at his legs. The left one looked just as long as the other. His eyes traveled up his body. A touch of the policeman's hand was still there, a touch that made his flesh jump like the tremor of a horse's flank when flies light on it. And something more, something like shame, stuck to his skin. Shame at being spread-eagled, fingered, and handcuffed. Shame at having stolen a skeleton, like a kid on a Halloween trick-or-treat prank, rather than a grown man making a hit. Shame at needing both his father and his aunt to get him off. Then more shame at seeing his father with an accommodating, we all understand how it is, smile, buckle before the policeman. But nothing was like the shame he felt as he watched and listened to Pilot. Not just her Aunt Jemima act, but the fact that she was both adept at it and willing to do it for him. For the one who had just left her house, carrying what he believed was her inheritance. It didn't matter that he also believed she had stolen it. From whom? From a dead man? From his father, who was also stealing it, then and now? He had stolen it too. And what's more, he had been prepared, at least he told himself he had been prepared, to knock her down if she had come into the room while he was in the act of stealing it. To knock down an old black lady who had cooked him his first perfect egg, who had shown him the sky, the blue of it, which was like her mother's ribbons, so that from then on, when he looked at it, it had no distance, no remoteness, but was intimate, familiar, like a room that he lived in, a place where he belonged. She had told him stories, sung him songs, fed him bananas and cornbread, and on the first cold day of the year, hot nut soup. And if his mother was right, this old black lady in her late 60s, but with the skin and agility of a teenage girl, had brought him into the world when only a miracle could have. It was this woman whom he would have knocked senseless, who shuffled into the police station and did a little number for the cops, opening herself up wide for their amusement, their pity, their scorn, their mockery, their disbelief, their meanness, their whimsy, their annoyance, their power, their anger, their boredom, whatever would be useful to her and to himself. Milkman sloshed his legs in the water. He thought again of how Guitar had looked at Pilate, the jeweled hatred in his eyes. He had no right to that look. Suddenly, Milkman knew the answer to the question he had never been able to ask Guitar. Guitar could kill, would kill, and probably had killed. The 7 days was the consequence of this ability, but not its origin. No. He had no cause to look at her like that, Milkman thought, and heaving himself upright in the tub, he soaped himself hurriedly. The September heat blasted him as soon as he got outside and wiped out the pleasant effects of his bath. Macon had taken the Buick. Age forced him to walk less, so Milkman went on foot to Guitar's house. As he rounded the corner, he noticed the familiar-looking gray Oldsmobile, a jagged crack in the rear window parked in front of the house. Several men were inside, and two were standing outside, Guitar and Railroad Tommy. Milkman slowed his steps. Tommy was talking while Guitar nodded his head. Then the two men shook hands. A handshake Milkman had never seen before. First, Tommy held Guitar's hand in both his own. Then Guitar held Tommy's hand in his too. Tommy got in the car, and Guitar dashed around the house to the side stairs that led to his room. The Oldsmobile, Milkman figured it was a 1953 or 1954 model, made a tight U-turn and headed toward him. When it passed by, all the occupants looked straight ahead. Porter was driving, with Empire State in the middle, and Railroad Tommy on the far side. And in the back seat was Hospital Tommy and a man named Nero. Milkman didn't know the other man. That must be them, he thought. His heart beat wildly. Six men, one of them Porter, and Guitar. Those are the days. And that car. That was the car that let Corinthians off near the house sometimes. Milkman had first assumed his sister has an occasional lift home from her job. Later, since she never mentioned it, and also because she seemed quieter and rounder lately, he decided she was seeing some man on the sly. He thought it was funny, sweet, and a little sad, but now he knew that whoever she was seeing belonged to that car and belonged to the 7 days. Foolish woman, he thought. Of all the people to pick, she was so silly, Jesus. He wasn't up to Guitar now. He would see him later. People behaved much better, were more polite, more understanding when Milkman was drunk. The alcohol didn't change him at all, but it had a tremendous impact on whomever he saw while he was under its influence. They looked better, never spoke above a whisper, and when they touched him, even to throw him out of the house party because he had peed in the kitchen sink, or when they picked his pockets as he dozed on a bench at the bus station, they were gentle, loving. He stayed that way, swaying from light buzz to stoned for 2 days and a night, and would have extended it to at least another day but for a sobering conversation with Magdalene called Lena, to whom he had not said more than 4 consecutive sentences since he was in the 9th grade. She was waiting for him at the top of the stairs when he came home early one morning. Wrapped in a rayon robe and without her glasses, she looked unreal, yet kind, like the man who had picked his pocket a short while ago. "Come here. I want to show you something. Can you come in here for a minute?" she was whispering. "Can't it wait?" He was kind, too, and he was proud of the civility in his voice, considering how tired he was. "No," she said, "no. You have to see it now, today. Just look at it." "Lena, I'm really beat out," he began in sweet reasonableness. "It won't take more than a minute. It's important." He sighed and followed her down the hall into her bedroom. She walked to the window and pointed. "Look down there." In what seemed to him like elegant if slow motion, Milkman went to the window, parted the curtain, and followed her pointing finger with his eyes. All he saw was the lawn at the side of the house. Not a thing was moving there, but in the light of early day, he thought he might have missed it. "What? That little maple, right there." She pointed to a tiny maple tree about 4 feet high. "The leaves should be turning red now. September's almost over, but they're not. They're just shriveling and falling down green." He turned to her and smiled. "You said it was important." He was not angry, not even irritated. He enjoyed his equanimity. "It is important, very important." Her voice was soft. She kept on staring at the tree. "Then tell me. I've got to go to work in a few minutes." "I know, but you can spare me a minute, can't you?" "Not to stare at a dead bush, I can't. It's not dead yet, but it will be soon. The leaves aren't turning this year." "Lena, you've been in the sherry." "Don't make fun of me," she said, and there was a hint of steel in her voice. "But you have, haven't you? You're not paying any attention to me." "I am. I'm standing here, listening to you tell me the news of the day, that a bush is dying." "You don't remember it, do you?" "Remember it? You peed on it." "I what?" "You peed on it." "Lena, maybe we can discuss this later. And on me." Lena, I have done some things in my life, some things I don't feel too good about, but I swear to God, I never peed on you." "It was summer, the year Daddy had that Packard. We went for a ride, and you had to go to the bathroom, remember?" Milkman shook his head. "No, I don't remember that." "I took you. We were in the country, and there was no place else to go. So they made me take you. Mama wanted to, but Daddy wouldn't let her, and he wouldn't go himself. Corinthians turned up her nose and refused outright, so they made me go. I had on heels, too. I was a girl, too, but they made me go. You and I had to slide down a little slope off the shoulder of the road. It was pretty back in there. I unbuttoned your pants and turned away so you could be private. Some purple violets were growing all over the grass and wild jonquil. I picked them and took some twigs from a tree. When I got home, I stuck them in the ground right down there." She nodded toward the window. "Just made a hole and stuck them in. I always liked flowers, you know. I was the one who started making artificial roses. Not Mama, not Corinthians, me. I loved to do it. It kept me quiet. That's why they make those people in the asylum weave baskets and make rag rugs. It keeps them quiet. If they didn't have the baskets, they might find out what's really wrong and do something. Something terrible. After you peed on me, I wanted to kill you. I even tried to once or twice, in little ways, leaving soap in your tub, things like that. But you never slipped and broke your neck or fell down the stairs or anything." She laughed a little. "But then I saw something. The flowers I'd stuck in the ground, the ones you peed on. Well, they died, of course. But not the twig. It lived. It's that maple. So I wasn't mad about it anymore. The pea, I mean. Because the tree was growing. But it's dying now, Macon." Milkman rubbed the corner of his eye with his ring finger. He was so sleepy. Yeah, well, that was a hell of a piss, wouldn't you say? You want me to give it another shot? Magdalene Colina drew one hand out of the pocket of her robe and smashed it across his mouth. Milkman stiffened and made an incomplete gesture toward her. She ignored it and said, "As surely as my name is Magdalene, you are the line I will step across." I thought, because that tree was alive, that it was all right. But I forgot there are all kinds of ways to pee on people. "You listen here." Milkman was sober now, and he spoke as steadily as he could. "I'm going to make some allowance for your sherry, up to a point, but you keep your hands off me. What is all this about peeing on people?" "You've been doing it to us all your life. You're crazy. When have I ever messed over anybody in this house? When did you ever see me telling anybody what to do or giving orders? I don't carry no stick. I live and let live. You know that. I know you told Daddy about Corinthians, that she was seeing a man secretly, and I had to. I'd love for her to find somebody, but I know that man. I've been around him, and I don't think he..." Milkman stopped, unable to explain about the days, about what he suspected. "Oh?" Her voice was thick with sarcasm. "You have somebody else in mind for her?" "No. No, but he's Southside, and not good enough for her. It's good enough for you, but not for her, right?" "Lena, what do you know about somebody not being good enough for somebody else? And since when did you care whether Corinthians stood up or fell down? You've been laughing at us all your life. Corinthians, Mama, me, using us, ordering us, and judging us. How we cook your food, how we keep your house. But now, all of a sudden, you have Corinthians' welfare at heart and break her up from a man you don't approve of. Who are you to approve or disapprove anybody or anything? I was breathing air in the world 13 years before your lungs were even formed. Corinthians 12. You don't know a single thing about either one of us. We made roses. That's all you knew. But now you know what's best for the very woman who wiped the dribble from your chin because you were too young to know how to spit. Our girlhood was spent like a found nickel on you. When you slept, we were quiet. When you were hungry, we cooked. When you wanted to play, we entertained you. And when you got grown enough to know the difference between a woman and a two-toned Ford, everything in this house stopped for you. You have yet to wash your own underwear, spread a bed, wipe the ring from your tub, or move a fleck of your dirt from one place to another. And to this day, you have never asked one of us if we were tired or sad, or wanted a cup of coffee. You've never picked up anything heavier than your own feet, or solved a problem harder than fourth grade arithmetic. Where do you get the right to decide our lives?" "Lena, cool it. I don't want to hear it." "I'll tell you where. From that hog's gut that hangs down between your legs. Well, let me tell you something, baby brother. You will need more than that. I don't know where you will get it or who will give it to you, but mark my words, you will need more than that. He has forbidden her to leave the house, made her quit her job, evicted the man, garnished his wages, and it is all because of you. You are exactly like him. Exactly. I didn't go to college because of him, because I was afraid of what he might do to Mama. You think because you hit him once that we all believe you were protecting her, taking her side? It's a lie. You were taking over, letting us know you had the right to tell her and all of us what to do." She stopped suddenly, and Milkman could hear her breathing. When she started up again, her voice had changed. The steel was gone, and in its place was a drifting, breezy music. When we were little girls, before you were born, he took us to the ice house once, drove us there in his Hudson.